Stein here, and welcome to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett, and glad to have you along today. I appreciate your time, appreciate whatever you're doing, happening right now, giving you an opportunity to check in and see what's happening with the Conscious Living. Now, one of the things that I like about being connected in this wonderful internet world is that you run across people in places that you would never have thought to look, and then they turn out to be associated with having been in your own backyard all along. And I was talking with one of the ladies here who is a part of a group that I was able to give presentations for off and on, and she said, you need to talk to Kimberly. She says, she used to be from this area. Just track her down. Okay, fine. So I did. Kimberly Clark Sharp, and she's from the Midwest. She has a book called After the Light, The Spiritual Path to Purpose. And since it fits really well with Conscious Living, I was just, it was such a nice surprise to find somebody from this area who had, really done a whole lot of work in the field of consciousness and near death studies. And that I'm really thrilled to have her talking with us today and see how that changed her life. Thank you, Kimberly. I appreciate your time.
Back at you. That's all I can say.
Well, there's a special thing about being, you know, from some place that you're familiar with and, you know, having that sense that I kind of know you, even though our paths haven't crossed. There's this sense of familiarity that comes with knowing a certain, I guess, geographical location tends to draw or create a background in people that makes them feel a sense of family. That's just how I explain it.
My throat clearing. I couldn't agree more. And in fact, it even applied to my marriage. I'm happily married, I might add. But my husband's from the Midwest, although we met in Seattle. And having those Midwestern roots, backgrounds, you know, same experience, culturally growing up, comfort foods the same, prayers at meals are the same. It is like family. It's and I don't know if it's only in the Midwest or if that applies to Boston or LA as well, but I know when I meet other Midwesterners, there's a shared sense of, well, here's that word, consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that probably happens anywhere in the world. You know, when people leave Peru and all of a sudden they meet in Australia or something. Oh, wow. Yeah. You're one of the homies.
Yeah, but I'd like to think it's just, you know, the Midwest. No.
Okay, that's
particularly Kansas City, particularly Leawood, Kansas.
Which is where I'm from.
Yeah,
you're shouting to the homies right now. That's what this is all
about.
Yes,
I am. Hi, everybody. Yeah. Hi, Mom.
Okay. Now, the deal is, though, you had a near-death experience that kind of catapulted you into a whole new area. And the interesting thing is, was it the DMV?
Yes. I was at the Department of Motor Vehicles in Shawnee Mission, Kansas, and in perfect health and not very old. I was 21, and with my dad, and I was waiting for my number to come up. I had drawn a number, and that is when God's sense of humor first came upon me, because my number sure did come up. I don't remember that day, except for my near-death experience, but I do know that I wound up in St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City, for those in the immediate area listening. These are all place names. And I had been dead.
Okay, that's interesting, you know, the DMV, because a lot of people really don't like that experience anyway. And then when you throw that on top of it, having your ticket
if
punch
you
and your number come up.
If you saw the photo I had taken that day, you too would have nearly died. So,
wow. Okay.
But up.
Well, all right. Now, finding yourself in the hospital, what was the initial... When you came to, or when you came to your, I guess, conscious awareness, how had your life changed in that span of not being here and then all of a sudden having the opportunity to come back?
Well, again, I don't remember that day other than my near-death experience. How it changed me, though, was from the inside out. Unbelievably. Afterwards, I would stare in the mirror, like slowly, like trying to see through my eyes what was different. But I knew that I wasn't the same person at all, and nor was I. I had a boldness that wasn't there before, heightened senses of awareness. I could see what we call angels, dead people, what I call demons. But I'm more comfortable now saying negative energy because it's more than just that scary biblical demonic things, which are all out there. It's a very crowded universe, Wendy. It's a hoot.
Yeah.
And I also then wound up going to the School of Social Work, got my graduate degree in social work at the University of Washington, and promptly diagnosed myself as schizophrenic. This was in the 70s. There was nothing coined. No books were written. There wasn't anyone like me out blabbing on the radio about the subject. There was a void, and I filled it with my own poor mental health, even though I didn't meet any of the criteria.
Yeah,
I ignored the criteria and just decided that I was nuts. And that remained in place until I had a patient. I went into critical care medicine. Actually taught in the School of Medicine at the University of Washington for 20 years, blah, blah, blah. But I had a patient in the late 70s who, while definitely dead, spotted a shoe on a ledge. And that's when I began to rethink everything and got to be one of the pioneers in what we now call the field of near-death studies. But I'm skipping over so much.
Yeah, you are. The shoe on the
listeners.
Ledge. What do you mean, the shoe on the ledge? I only halfway heard that.
I would rather, hold that shoe by a shoelace and get back to how I got to the heightened awareness, my own near-death experience, if that's okay.
Yeah.
In other words, may I drive this interview for a few minutes?
You certainly may.
Thank you.
It's about you.
Well, but it's about the greater subject, too, of how we're all loved, how we're all super aware humans populating this lonely planet, and how much we need each other. And, oh, there's so much to share in just an hour. But what got me to this place was not waking up in the hospital and wondering what the heck happened. It was my near-death experience. And that was a doozy. So I, like I said, I don't remember that day, except as my father told me. I do remember what he said, and according to my dad, I did sign up. Eventually my number did come up. I signed everything just fine, walked outside, collapsed into and through his arms on the sidewalk in front of the DMV. Back then, no cell phones, of course, but someone called the Shawnee Mission Department of the fire department, and they had volunteer firefighters who promptly showed up. Someone else had called St. Luke's Hospital, if I may use these place names. An ambulance was being sent. According to my father, which is the only report on this level of awareness, the everyday stuff.
Yeah.
According to my dad, the firefighters came first, worked on me. They had a portable ventilator that had two functions, and they had not had any practice. It was in new packaging, according to my dad. They ripped it open, applied the portable ventilator to my mouth, established that there wasn't an air leak, that it was a tight seal, turned it on. Well, of all things, it was on vacuum mode. And this was the new feature of the portable ventilators of that era. The reason that one would want to vacuum instead of provide air into a body is in case there was something blocking the airway.
I figured
that's
drowning.
Why we tell our kids, you know, don't run with candy in your mouth, food in your mouth.
Yes, okay, all right. Yeah.
Sometimes
marbles,
people choke in a restaurant, but you can apply all the ventilation in the world, but if something's blocking, you know, our mouth and our lungs,
right,
ain't nothing going to happen. So there wasn't anything blocking my airway, however. So what happened is that the oxygen in my body was immediately and violently sucked out. That was a disaster. They flicked a switch, turned the ventilator in the other direction to actually ventilate, but my lungs in part had collapsed, we learned later, and the air had to go somewhere, so it found its way finally to my skin, to my epidermis, and I literally inflated like a flesh balloon, something called epithelial emphysema, most certainly fatal. So now I've got two things really wrong. In addition to the fact I collapsed without breathing in a heartbeat in the first place, that, you know, little things happen that are meant to in our lives. I firmly know that now at my age. When I had first collapsed, a uniformed nurse happened to be passing by. And that was the first kind of miracle of the day, because she's the one who determined that I wasn't breathing, didn't have a heart rate. And that's what set everything in motion. But now things were set in a serious reverse motion. The medics stopped what they were doing and told my father there was nothing more they could do, which in every state in the United States to this day, only a physician can officially, unless there's, you know, a corpse on the floor that's got rigor mortis, only a physician can pronounce a death, not a volunteer firefighter from Shawnee Mission, at least in those days. So they said the euphemism, there's nothing more we can do. And at that point, a man my dad calls, always had called, the Good Samaritan, came forward. He had tremendous strength. He was pushing people aside, again, with authority. He was also swearing like a mule skinner. So our family joke was that he must have been from the Missouri side of Kansas City, because people in Kansas surely still don't swear. And he started to do what we now call mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and chest compression. Good old citizen CPR. Mm-hmm. But back then, it hadn't been invented. It was about to, though, I have to say. It was about to, but it hadn't happened yet. So he was doing citizen CPR and finally stopped and said to my dad, I'm not getting a blank, blank thing. And my dad's memory ends there. So if you're still with me, Wendy, I'd like to share what I experienced on a completely different level.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, okay, so this was the year, what, 1971?
1970, May 25th, 1970.
Okay.
Beautiful Saturday morning. I also have to add that there wasn't a lot of distractions on May 25th, Saturday morning in 1970 in Shawnee Mission, because I thought it was amusing. My father said it was like street theater. More and more and more people came, and at one point, the ambulance from St. Luke's Hospital did arrive, and somewhere in there, I began breathing on my own. I was still unconscious. My father said there was a great cheer. You know, it was like a sporting event. So I just figured people got on their phones at home and said, you got to go down to the DMV. There's a girl dead down there. It was the morning's entertainment for a lot of people. Very
it was a
dramatic,
simple life
though.
Back then, yes.
Yeah, they're just, you know, there weren't a lot of distractions. So anyway, what I remember is a woman's voice on my left saying, I'm not getting a pulse, I'm not getting a pulse. And I spoke to her with the same sense of reality with which I'm now speaking to you, Wendy, which tells me now, decades in healthcare, even though we have no appearance of breathing or cardiac activity, does not mean that our sense of hearing is gone. And I have taught that all these years. when deceased loved ones come to a bedside and want to say a few words to the body, I say, go for it, because I truly believe they can hear you. Same with healthcare personnel, you know, watch your mouths around someone who is near death or has just died, because I know they can still hear. As it turns out, this was a validating point, because it was, according to my father, the nurse, the uniform nurse, who was saying, in fact, on my left side, I'm not getting a pulse, I'm not getting a pulse. So heard her clearly, and in fact tried to talk to her, thought I was talking to her, and wound up being in the awkward position of comforting her, saying, of course I'm getting a pulse, otherwise I wouldn't be talking, because she was so nervous and then just anxiety laden, and it wasn't helping, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that was my own judgment, and it was wrong. She was helping a great deal, but I just couldn't figure out what the heck she was talking about. And then that faded away, and I found myself in an area surrounded by warm, dense, gray, foggy material. And I knew I wasn't alone, and I felt like I was waiting for something. The foggy material, again, became a point of validation, because, as it turns out, in World War II, when this planet Earth was in the greatest threat of internal destruction, at least from people, there were more movies made about the afterlife than at any other time in cinema history. And that was true in every country that was producing movies. So Japan, India, Britain, Germany, United States. And my point is that every last one of those circa World War II afterlife movies involves a gray, foggy material, like a transition point. And they're wonderful movies.
Yeah, that's
movies.
A really interesting footnote.
Yeah, isn't it? So I think there's like a corridor of consciousness that we all go through between worlds, so to speak, and some people make a U-turn.
I agree, and I have experienced that particular element. It was in a dream state, and I remember having my angel book and thinking, okay, I'm going to hold on to this. When I was coming back through the clouds into body, I'd been out of body. And I remember, okay, I'm going to take this with me. And then I felt it slip. They would not let me bring it with me. I'm like, ah, but I knew everything that was important was in that book. And I was determined to bring it with me back to my conscious state of being. And it didn't happen.
Darn.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. But that
would
that
have been
gray,
sweet.
That gray in between. And it's a very real state.
Like between worlds or something. Yeah.
Awareness.
Very real. It was so, yeah. It was a place. Well, then that place got literally blown away, just dissolved in the presence of I have no words for this, and usually there's a lot of emotion. And I wish, in a way, we could see each other, Wendy, because I get tears in my eyes, and I can't make light of this, but a light showed up. But it wasn't a light like a light bulb light or the sun. It was brighter than the sun. It was a million times brighter, if that's possible. I have no way of describing this light other than it was illuminating. It came out from under me and just, like I said, just exploded all of the foggy material away, and it was what I was waiting for. Everything just went, within my soul, if you will. Sorry, but I get a little verklempt, because this light was love, just nothing but pure love. If I had been in flesh and bone, I would have not been able to withstand it. I call this light God. I'm very comfortable calling it my creator. No words.
The
love.
Source? I mean, source? Does that
absolute is another? Absolute source. Absolutely. The first thing I said, although I didn't have a mouth or a voice, but I remember saying, homie home. Again, a little validating point, because I later learned from my parents that homie home is what I used to say when I was learning language and we had been away from the neighborhood and pulling back into familiar territory. I would look around and go, homie home, knowing mm-hmm. that I was almost back to my toys. And my parents, you know, for them, it was one of those bougie, bougie, boo moments of, you know, isn't Kimmy cute? And I don't remember. That was, I was about two. I have no memory of being two. So, but when I told that, when I shared that with my folks, that they were interested because that was my cute little saying, homie home.
That was the code.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I said in the presence of this light, homie home.
Mm-hmm. So and it was. What do you feel from the light? Aside from that love, do you feel, is there a language, something that's being telepathically transmitted to you, or is it just that energy?
No. We had a wonderful little chat. It was great. The language would be impossible to describe because it was a combination of math and music. And I have a metaphor or two for that, but I have no way to describe that. I also have no skills in math and music. I can't add, subtract, multiply, or divide. My longstanding joke is, and this has just happened, to balance the family checkbook, I just change accounts every January, and that's God's truth. And
that's
then I know how
plan.
Much we have. Yeah, by Christmas,
safe.
I have no idea how much money is in the bank, and I'm spending it anyway. It's Christmas, yay! Now things are in austerity because I do know how much is in the bank. And, so that's my math skills and music. My piano teacher quit me during Song of the Volga Boatmen. You know, da, da, da. And my apologies, Wendy and dear listeners, I'm on my house phone and have call waiting. And that's what's happening on the other line. So, that everyone listening, and that's the last beep, will forgive me for not knowing how to turn this stupid thing off.
No, that's fine. At least it's not your number coming up again.
That's true. Wendy, good one. Good one. So anyway, so here's God talking to me. He was actually answering questions I had, and I had some doozies. One question was, basically, why are we born? What's the whole point? And Wendy, I did not have the maturity to even formulate these questions. There was another part of me that I feel was ego-driven going, well, that was a really good question. Mm-hmm. But I did ask, what's the whole point of this? And what I got back was that we had begged as souls, and that our souls, well, this conversation went on forever because there was no time. But for the sake of this short time we have in the interview, skip the questions, tell you the answers, that our souls are eternal, that Earth is like school. We're in different grades, but we're all here. We're to help each other. The whole point is love. I asked about pain and suffering, and it was basically, and sadly, that we don't turn to spirit, we don't turn to God, we don't turn to prayer, usually, unless we're under duress as humans. And that reminds us that we have spiritual support available to us. It just went on and on, and there was no time whatsoever. And it was heaven. For me, it was just being beyond happy, beyond joy, beyond secure. It was just unconditional love, something that even as I'd like to think a loving parent, I love my kids unconditionally, but I don't. There's conditions like make your bed. You know, this was so pure. And I might add, jumping ahead to my survival, it's been a handy-dandy little emotional tool. Nobody and nothing can get me down, Wendy, because I know God loves me.
Yeah.
And I know God loves you and everybody else. So
it
becomes an equal playing field, which also as a social worker is a wonderful perspective in my approach to some people, especially that I may not care to interact with on any other level. But I love them. I love them because I know God loves them.
Well, I think you can be more empathic because you understand it's not really about the visual that you're getting. It's about the soul, the being inside.
Right. And this is, you know, I don't mean to take anyone off who's listening, but it applies to bad guys, too. I watched, you know, and listened with horror this last week about the five-year-old. And of course, there was Newton. I mean, we have our villains all over the place. I mean, definitely people that are determined to hurt others. But I have to love them. It's not that I'm choosing to. I love them. I understand that even the bad guys were born in innocence. And are there any bad guys? Are we just simply products of, like, brain miswiring and bad child care? I mean, bad being raised by people that weren't nice to us, so we became not nice. But honestly, God loves everybody. And I'm just so happy about that, happy to know it completely. So then I heard what no one would want to hear in that position, and that's that I had to go back. And I argued. Anyone would. I told you, anyone would. I said no in this math and music combination. Oh, I mentioned a metaphor for the math and music. It came in the late 70s with the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
When
the mothership is finally landing towards the end of the movie and all these scientists are gathered around Devil's Tower and this huge ship lands and it plays the now famous notes, da, da, you know, remember? And there is a scientist, young scientist, on a keyboard imitating the notes.
Mm-hmm.
Those notes are then fed into these, they go through these thick cables and go to computers that were the size of buses in the movie. But the computer was changing the musical notes into mathematical pieces of information that the scientists could then read.
Yeah.
And I watched that movie and thought, who the heck is this guy who came up with this plot? Unbelievable. And that, so that was my first chance to explain to others what it's like, this math and music communication.
Okay,
also,
hang
by
on.
The
let's
way,
take a break because I have
already,
a question about
I'm sorry.
That.
Thank you for interrupting at a timely time.
Yeah, well, no, it's okay. Just hang on to that thought. And I have a question in reference to that musical language and that particular movie. We'll do that in just a minute here. We're talking with Kimberly about her near-death experience and her life from then. Kimberly Clark Sharp. You can read her book. We'll come back and talk with her more here on Conscious Living at Empower Radio. I'm Wendy Garrett.
My sport is football, but my passion is education. My name is Nnamdi Asamoah, and this is how I live United. I see too many kids miss out on moving up. Kids who could go on to college, but just need that extra little push. So every year, I take promising high school students on a college tour. We check out the dorms, the library, meet some professors, find out where the best late night grub stops are. It shows them that there's a whole world beyond their own. But what's even better is that most of these kids decide college is for them. I'm Nnamdi Asamoah. I show kids that a higher education means a brighter future. So when it comes to living United, I don't just wear the shirt. I live it. Join me.
It takes all of us working together to make a difference. Find out how you can live United for Education. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on and lost cat stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Hi there, this is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. I like that the spots are about lost cat magnets and Smokey Bear. Smoking cats. Hi there, hope you're having a good time. We're talking with Kimberly Clark Sharp, her book, After the Light, The Spiritual Path to Purpose. And this event she's talking about happened in 1970, really when very little of this kind of information was available. And in my opinion, it takes at least 10 years to process something that's like this a huge transformative life event. So even you know, being at a place of understanding that you had it, it's how does it affect you? And it affects you on so many levels that the world isn't the same when you come back to this part of reality. And you were talking about having that moment trying to, you know, assess the language and getting the movie Close Encounters and seeing and hearing the code, which was the music. And saying that was it, that gave you a way of sharing, giving people a metaphor or,
yes,
or you know, something.
Finally. that movie and others since then, you know, film is something that we can all rally around, those of us who enjoy movies. And so I was always grateful. But you had something you were going to say.
Well, I want to know if there's a sense of, you know, there's a lot more as you begin to be more metaphysically aware, involved of other beings, multidimensional, transdimensional, whatever you want to call it, extraterrestrial. Have you had encounters since then that also gave you a feeling that it wasn't just about the humans in the equation?
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, it's a very crowded place. It's just that most of it's invisible. But, you know, it's been my privilege, an honor, actually, to be like the opposite of a midwife. Anyone who's spent time around a dying person, especially in huge numbers, and again, my career now spans decades, so I know lots of dead people, and to be able to continue their relationship, even though they're not using their bodies anymore. The relationship, though, in my experience, has only lasted days after a death. I also believe that we can attend our own funeral if we choose to, based on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea is that we do need to go to the light, and we may pop up again from time to time. I even wonder if we're not their heaven. You know, I know I would want to be able to check on my kids from the other side from time to time. So, yeah, awareness is about that. Nothing extraterrestrial. It's all been spiritual. What we would call angels.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of angel experiences, which is really why I wrote After the Light. It got to be ridiculous. I had massive academic credentials, but this other side to me that was panning out, I was using it in my social work and medical practice, the use of invisibilities, and I just thought I better write about it because this might help somebody, and by golly, it has.
Well, and you had to get over the schizophrenic part.
Oh, that went away with the shoe on the ledge. Okay, so we'll get to that.
Back to the shoe.
So now I'm a young social worker, April 1977, which was a banner year. It For a near-death experience, it's estimated that it takes about 7 years to assimilate. And this was 7 years later, you know, with me happily misdiagnosing myself. And April 77 is when the shoe on the ledge story happened, when, for those who don't remember Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, look her up, because you'll learn a lot.
Right.
It's the first time a woman came up to Elizabeth that month, that year, and said, something happened to my son I want to tell you about, which was a near-death experience. And that month, Raymond Moody, who's still with us, wrote a book called Life After Life. And then came The Shoe on the Ledge, which is the most famous out-of-body experience anywhere at any time, because it is so validated. So what happened is that I was working at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, which is a University of Washington medical center. I worked on critical care, which was huge, because Harborview serves a landmass then and now of one-fourth of the United States. So it's a huge hospital, huge critical care unit. People from all over the world come to study there. And it's a good place to have a heart attack, Seattle. That's been said for a long, long time. So one of my patients was a woman, a migrant worker, who had never been to Seattle. She was from Eastern Washington, where we have our crops. She, the evening of her arrival, had a huge heart attack, was admitted because of a variety of social work needs. I spent a lot of time with her in the next few days, mainly just getting translators lined up, you know, just very practical social worky things. Mm-hmm. One day, I was working on charts in the room where all the monitors are observed by a nurse. And one of the monitors started to go beep, flatlining. And it was Maria. Because Harborview is a teaching hospital, you don't get just a doctor and a nurse and a respiratory therapist if you stop breathing.
You get a classroom.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you get everybody. I mean, I swear people from food services were up there. Her room was packed out. There were actually a dozen people, I counted. So I was the baker's dozen. I was standing in the doorway, watched a very easy resuscitation, went about my business. After she was back into what's called normal sinus rhythm, she was still unconscious, though. And then later in the day, I got a page back up to the critical care unit. Maria was awake and so agitated, they couldn't find a translator. You know, Kim, do something, do something. They were afraid she's going to flip right back into cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in there with my Shawnee Mission East 3 years of Spanish under my belt. And here's how the conversation finally boiled down. The translator ultimately arrived, but after the fact. Maria was able to tell me where she was during her resuscitation, which was not in her bed. She pointed at a place in the ceiling. And she told me correctly who was in the room. I chose to not believe her because I thought, well, I already knew that you could hear, you know, what's going on after death. And so she just was hearing familiar people's voices and putting it, not that she was deliberately lying, but her brain was trying to figure out all the muddlement. And then she said that, she found herself just like that, snap of a finger, hovering above the emergency room door. And again, I discounted her because her room was above the emergency room door, and I thought someone from housekeeping had simply pushed her bed by the window, and she had observed the comings and goings. Well, she was hooked up to so many wires, Wendy. No way anyone was from housekeeping was going to unplug this woman to clean, you know, a stain under the bed. But the reason I was choosing to not believe her is that I was firmly in my own belief that I was crazy, and what she was saying was not in alignment with my self-diagnosis. But then she said she found herself on another side of the building, three or four stories above the ground, and she was on the second floor, her body was on the second story. And she she was what she basically was, eyeball to shoelace with a tennis shoe. One large, dark blue tennis shoe sitting on the lead that had a white lace that went under the heel. Very detailed reporting for someone who was dead. And the reason she was agitated is that she wanted someone to go get the shoe. And that turned out to be me.
It was out of place.
It was nuts. And she didn't know where she was. So I had this is a mammoth building. I had to scramble all kinds of places to look for a shoe on the ledge. But finally, on the west side of the building, I saw a bird. I was looking outside. I hadn't thought of looking inside, walking around. But I saw a bird land on a ledge, and then I couldn't see the bird. So I thought, oh, dang, I'm going to have to go inside and start looking. And I did. It took forever. But finally, third floor, walked across the patient's room, looked down, and there was a dark blue tennis shoe, exactly as she had described it, on the ledge. And that was my watershed moment. That's also when I learned that in complete shock, one cannot support one's own body weight. I just went thunk, and I would have fallen to the floor, except that my forehead hit the glass. And out loud, I said, this happened to me, and I remember the fog momentarily from my breath coating the window pane.
Mm-hmm.
And it all came together then. I wasn't crazy, because I knew Maria wasn't crazy. And I picked up the shoe and took it downstairs. And back then, people who were sick actually stayed in the hospital until they were well, go figure. And that shoe sat there like the Shroud of Turin for three weeks. And I still have the shoe. And it's in my garage, and many people have said, well, if you show me the shoe, then I'll believe. And I say to them, you clean my garage, you can see the shoe.
The Ark of the Covenant.
That just, huh?
Like the Ark of the Covenant. It's somewhere. It's very, very important.
We have a 900-square-foot garage filled with my crap, if you don't mind me saying so. And family stuff, and on, and it's out there somewhere. So I decided then there's got to be more. So I began to ask every person brought in, quote-unquote, dead, or every person who was resuscitated on the floor, what they remembered. And I asked three questions, and I asked them to this very day. What I will be doing at 2 o'clock this afternoon is having the same kind of interview, and that is, what do you remember that led up to your death or the trauma? You know, fill in the blank, Wendy, but you know, the car accident, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember during that time? And if there's been, if it's not hospital-based, then I ask them, how has it changed your life? And that's it. And that was April. It wasn't until June when someone actually answered those questions, the 16-year-old who was in on an overdose. Here's a suicide attempt, and a kid, of all things. And she found herself in the arms of her oompa. That was Grandpa. She was so young when Grandpa died, she couldn't say Grandpa. It was oompa. And he held her and gave her what for and sent her back. There was no hell. I could do a whole hour on suicide stuff, but no hell, no massive punishment, just a bad choice. And I even hate to say bad, because for some people, it's the only choice, but that's a whole other subject.
When you get into these stories, it is, and from the judgmental thing that we have here, that we really are fixated on calling everything right and wrong, it blows that out of the water.
Right. There's still love for us on the other side. It's just that, you know, it's important to stay in school, just like real school, if using God's own metaphor, if this is school, yeah, we got to do our homework and stick to it. But if we flunk out, it's not like we disappear. We just need to learn a better way of learning. That's all. So, but any listeners contemplating it, call me before you do anything to hurt yourself, because it's still, as the old saying goes, it's still a permanent solution to a temporary problem. But anyway, so that was interesting. And I had a graduate student in 1995 who did a nose count of all of the people on record that I had interviewed face-to-face. So no email, no phone calls, certainly no one else's cases. And it was 2,000. So I stopped counting. Also, 31 years ago, I founded the world's oldest and largest support group for near-death experiencers, which can be found on the website for the International Association for Near-Death Experiences, or IANDS, IANDS.org. Anywho, we have over 5,000 people on our database, 5,000 separate people who've, over the 30 years, have come to the meetings. There are a lot of people out there almost dying or having similar experiences without being in physical danger.
Have you worked with Jeffrey, the guy who's with the NDERF? Is it near death?
Research? Here's my brag. He's out of my group.
Okay.
Yeah,
because he's the doctor.
He's now living in Louisiana, but long before a book, there was Dr. Jeffrey Long and his wife sitting in our group. They're local folk. Yep.
Okay.
Anyone you could name that I don't know. I feel like the ghost in the machine. I know everybody. And,
well, and PMH Atwater.
Known her since she was a child. No. But I've known her. We met in early 80s. And at that time, she had written one self-published book. Hadn't done anything else. We were both babies. On and on. The list. I met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in a bathroom line. And we bonded over near-death experiences. I just have been put in the right place at the right time every moment in my life.
Well, and if you're listening to this, the book, After the Light, The Spiritual Path to Purpose, has endorsements from Dr. Moody, also Betty Eady and Dr. Kenneth Ring, Melvin Morse. This is a really good group of folks who are saying, read the book.
They love me.
Good thing is they're living. Okay, that kind of helps.
Also, what also helps is that I write like I talk. So if you're hanging on to this conversation, I write very Midwestern. I write just like this, just plain talk. But yeah,
you're
Betty
real
Eady,
people.
Betty Eady is out of my group, out of Seattle IANDS. It's just hilarious. Yeah,
well, the big one that I think got a lot of people's attention recently, there's two. Anita Morjani, I believe.
We published her story in our newsletter for the very first time. Mm-hmm. There was no Anita out there until our group has $10 a year. You too can get a newsletter. It took two issues, but yeah, she was, quote unquote, we discovered her.
Yeah. Well, then Evan Alexander.
Yeah, met him a year before he wrote a book at a conference in Durham where he actually shared his experience for the first time in public. But it's not about me. I'm having fun right now, it's just what I was sent back to do is to encourage, facilitate, to love. I think everybody should write a book, though. Wendy, you write a book. Everyone's got a story. Everyone has an interesting story.
I'll share
People
mine.
It's
a different story, and it's happening right now, and it has since 1997.
Ooh.
It's called Talking to Nightlights, and it, for me, was a divine awakening into, without having a near-death experience, something, big and grandiose. It was just a little small thing. I discovered an interaction with spirit that happened to affirm to me in a way that I could see and visualize, and I see now, and I have since 1997. The blinking and flickering of a light. And this light is basically electrical energy that lets us know we're never alone. And some people have other ways of connecting. I hear it. I see it. I sense it. I feel it. And it's real for me.
Absolutely. And you know what you know. But you know, kind of.
Yeah.
No one's going to be able to. The flickering lights, we should talk. Oh, wait, we are. But, yeah, One thing about a near-death experience, it's one of the few things that can actually be measured, but there is a change in electromagnetic output, as it were. So near-death experiencers frequently complain about lights going out
mm-hmm.
or flickering.
Mm-hmm.
I myself can be on the keyboard, and if there are any kind of earth shifts, that's also electromagnetic, and I feel it to my elbows. And know to get out the masking tape and tape my cupboard shut because we're going to have a tremor.
See, what my information, the way that they have given me the words for it, the language, is the bioelectric energy. And that's how we're all connected. And that's how we are connected with those things that are unseen in our realm. And so if there's an influx, or if we attune or work our own vibration, with whether it's through meditation or through a way of thinking, and tuning yourself to maybe a higher sense of awareness and a more loving space, there's no rocket science behind it. It's just a matter of each person doing the homework it is required to make themselves more sensitive to other awarenesses and other states of being.
Homework, you and other people, though, or near-death experiencer, have just walked into this knowledge without any preparation, just kaboom, it's there. It's available to everybody, and it's better than a party game. I mean, it's being aware of all this stuff is so much fun.
Well, it makes life a different kind of experience. You get out of the lockstep of everything has to be done a certain way, and these are the good people and these are the bad people, and everybody should always be fighting over who's better at being bad and better at being good.
Yeah, let's go to war again.
Yeah, or let's go buy some new shoes. Sorry.
Well, no. That could be spiritual, Wendy.
Okay, metaphorically speaking.
I'm hoping to have my own little cosmic credit card in heaven, you know, and it better say Nordstrom's.
Okay, that's
choose
the thing.
To be a spiritual event.
That's the thing. When people are out there doing this out-of-body and, you know, near-death experience, they could also look for lost socks.
Where does the other sock go? That is the great question I would like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, will someone please get on Wendy's show and answer that question? The world will be tuning in. Where is the other sock?
I'm surprised you didn't ask God about that when you had his ear or his light.
I'm sorry I let humanity down with that one, mm-hmm. didn't I? The
See,
most
there was
important
a big one.
Question of all.
What was
right
the most important
after,
thing you
asked?
Right
after, where are my car keys? You know, it's those two things. So,
what was the most important thing you ask, you think?
Why are we born? Yeah, that we actually begged for this existence, as painful and as horrible as life can be, that we really did bang on the door for every breath we take. Thus, every breath is precious. And it will end as we know it. Even if one believes in reincarnation, this life will end. These relationships will end. This is where the hugs are. And obviously I'm a hugger. But that was probably the most, if I had to choose offhand, I've never been asked that question actually, the most important question. Yeah, and then, of course, above all that is just the knowledge that we're loved. There are no accidents. That's why the subtitle of the book was The Spiritual Path to Purpose. I mean, we all have a purpose, though. People rattle around, you know, sometimes and ask me, well, what's my purpose, Kim? I don't know, honey.
Yeah.
But you have one because you're alive. So... It takes the edge off of me on some really crummy days to know that I chose it.
Yeah.
So, you know, suck it in and get through that dental appointment or, I mean, whatever might be challenging me.
Okay,
it's all good, and
we're
all
down
guided
to the last,
all
like,
the
2 minutes.
Time. Oh, time goes so fast in a radio show.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
I've had a wonderful time, and this is not a typical interview for me. Usually there are... you know, lots of interruptions and with commercials and stuff. And this whole time, I've been in my home phone, sitting in my living room, having coffee, talking with Wendy. It's been very relaxing, very fun. I hope you invite me back sometime.
Oh, I would
local
love to.
Local girl like a, makes
it's
good.
It's like the tip of the iceberg. Well, there's
I have a lot to share.
Okay,
I have
so,
a lot of stories. You know, we could get off the subject of moi. And yeah, I've gone a long time telling
okay,
stories.
Okay, so hold on. Don't throw them all out now. What we're going to do
I'm
is
I'm not
going to
throw any
appearance.
Out. That's a tease.
We'll book a repeat appearance. But I want you okay. to share your book, okay, for, since we're wrapping up and how they can get in touch with you real quick.
Well, the book is called After the Light. And it's available. You can go to your bookstore. If it's not in stock, they can order it for you. And, of course, you know, good old internet. You'll be inside of my brain. It was the Literary Guild Alternate Book of the Month. And so that's a huge writing award. There's only 12 of those per year. And it's funny and wise and wonderful, or so say my readers.
Well,
that's a plug. I don't mean there's no ego base in that. Just read the dang book.
Yeah, I know. It's like here.
And then get in touch with me. I'm very available. Not rich, not famous. Just here. Happy to help.
Just real. Okay.
I'm a
cheap okay. Now
date.
She does have some connections. I'm going to bang the drum here real quick. One of the 40 most influential people under the age of 40. In 1987 in the Pacific Northwest. Okay, so that's like a little laurel. And then the founder of Seattle International Association of Near-Death Studies, and that's the oldest and largest support group for the near-death experiencers.
Yeah, and you can find me on the internet, too, by ions.org or Kimberly Clark Sharp. And I'm pages and pages of Google. So, Google. Yeah, get a hold of me.
One-stop shopping Google. We're going to talk again, okay? So you have a wonderful day. Hang on.
Thank you, Wendy.
We'll talk with you after the break. And if you're listening, be sure and check out Conscious Living on Empower Radio for other really fun and interesting shows. And maybe you'll find something new that appeals to you and gets you enthusiastic about living and exploring reality. There's a whole lot more here than we have yet to fathom. See ya.